Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here, sitting across from me in his new chair.
In my new chair is Mike Cosentino, the co-host, and there is Silent Gary. Silent.
Who's not terribly silent.
Not terribly silent.
Not terribly silent. Who's been, we promoted him last week to senior super something.
I don't remember what it is. We gave you a really good title, Gary.
Well, we're calling him the interventionist.
Yeah.
When you and I get bogged down into, silliness, then Gary comes along and intervenes, which is our theme this morning, by the way.
Yes.
A different kind of intervention.
I don't know what to call it except endless interventionism.
Endless intervention.
Endless intervention.
The U.S. appetite
we'll for focus on intervention. American intervention, but we're not exactly the only guys doing this stuff.
This is sort of regardless of administration, isn't it?
It does seem to have a life of its own. There was an article in Mother Jones by a really good writer, Kevin Drum. And he says that Obama's not wanting to intervene militarily, he's talking about military,
yeah,
in the way we've done in the past is bone deep, that he has a deep, deep opposition to it. And yet we see him intervening over and over again. He intervenes in Libya. And as a military strategy, it works fine. It costs us almost no money.
Right.
We have no casualties. Gaddafi is a murderous SOB,
yeah,
and he's gone.
Right.
But then the country goes into terrible chaos. And I think that one of the people we wanted to talk to was Richard Falk. And what he said was there never was an Arab Spring in Libya.
Right.
There never was a civic society. There never was a youth movement for democracy and stuff there. So when we successfully, and we took a sort of back seat, which was really appalled the neoconservatives and the interventionists, we
right.
let the British and the French do most of the work,
right.
and we supported them. And it worked just on an amazingly clear timetable, and then the country over the next first we had Benghazi, and then we knew there was a problem, and then over the next two years, things have just gotten worse and worse and worse.
But that's key to what we're talking about this morning, and that's the intervention. Ism. And now I want to say that real quickly. You know, we're talking about U.S. going to war with everybody in the Middle East. Every year or so, we find somebody new to go to war with. We bomb the crap out of them, and then as we're going to talk about mission creep.
Yes.
We want to replace regime change. All of a sudden, we have these protracted wars. But I tell you this much: the guys down at the coffee shop, my conservatives, like Obama for one reason only, and that is he has not done the Republican thing. He has not started a war with Yemen or with Iran or with anybody.
And that's kind of what we should talk about, because the neoconservatives, the interventionists, are very, very unhappy with Obama's policies, and they're blaming him for things that are happening in the Middle East that have been decades in the making.
Right.
And I guess to frame it one way is if there's anything worse, I see if you guys agree with me. If there's anything worse than one of these vicious dictators like Saddam Hussein,
yeah,
or Muammar Gaddafi,
right,
it's the chaos that follows,
right,
the violence that follows, the casualties that follow. If there's anything worse than Assad in Syria, it's the chaos of the civil war that killed, several hundred thousand people now there, or exiled?
It's our complete misunderstanding of the region. It's, the God of unintended consequences is always at work, and we think the consequences are going to be like they would be here's a dictator that's losing power, and yet the rise of militant Islam
is one of
those unintended consequences.
Is this a problem of the competency, Gary, of American policy, or is there something fundamentally? In other words, do we not know enough about Yemen to intervene effectively, or is it
is it a deeper problem with intervening at all? What do you think?
I was just going to say, I think a lot of the problem is the fact that we keep our intervention is based on these proxy wars, that the enemy of our enemy is our friend. And so when we support the overthrow or stand on the sidelines for an overthrow, the reason there's so much chaos after the fact is that there is no entity, no planned government for after the fall of the dictator. It's all just let's get rid of the dictator and then democracy will take its course.
But never has worked, Gary.
Democracy never. Is never a Rarely. Natural progression of that because many of these countries just end up going from dictator to dictator to dictator. And our foreign policy has often been based on which dictator best supports our corporations, not on what's good for human rights or for democracy.
Okay, so that brings a question, you know, and I think what you've raised is that the United States has ulterior motives. And I saw this list of American military interventions, Gary, and I was going to print it out, and I thought, my God, this is longer than one of Gary's printouts.
I made my own list.
I mean, it was like it would be like 10 pages of interventions over, and it starts in the 1880s and it goes all the way forward.
You could make an argument it began in the 1600s with the Native Americans.
And that's true too. Now, I mean, there's intervention and there's interventionism. In other words, the American people have always been really reluctant to intervene in other countries. And
we have?
Yeah, well, in the old days.
Republicans have never met a war they don't like.
I'm talking about before Republicans. The problem starts with the American Revolution. The Americans are going to throw out the British, only they can't really without an alliance with France. So the first intervention is basically getting the French to help bail us out of this war against the British. So we may talk about being about intervention and not having entangling alliances, but when we actually need them, it goes all the way back to the early, before the country even exists, we're calling for foreign help.
You can track almost all of our problems back to the racist notion of manifest destiny, that people of color around the world are unable to govern themselves, so it's up to the white people of the U.S.
That.
Well, that was what drove us into Asia.
What do you think, Mike?
Well, I think that's a stretch. We're talking about foreign policy here, not.
Well, that was foreign policy.
Then, yeah.
Why do we think that we always have the solution? We went into Vietnam. We didn't know anything about Vietnam. We didn't know Jack blank about Vietnam, and we went in there and we got lost all these people and spent billions and billions of dollars.
We didn't even know
who the Vietnamese were. It wasn't just the American public didn't know, but there were almost no experts who understood Vietnamese culture. Yet we went in big time, and we went in there supporting an unpopular dictator.
Right.
And we've done that over and over again. Sometimes the dictator just lasts for decades after decades.
Doesn't this sound weird, familiar? Like Castro. I mean, our opposition to him kept him in office 50 years.
So are we arrogant in thinking that we can solve these people's cultures? Because every time we intervene recently, anyway, it's really gone bad. I mean, when we intervened after World War II in Europe and helped rebuild Europe, it all worked very, very well.
Yeah,
but all these other interventions the solution from the neoconservatives, right, and from the interventionist liberals and stuff is that always we need a bigger footprint. What went wrong in Libya? There weren't American troops there. What went wrong in Syria? We didn't send in troops. We didn't send enough money to the guys that are supposed to be good. What went wrong with Iraq? Well, we had to stay there probably forever for things to work out right. Same way with Afghanistan. We needed tens of thousands of more troops and casualties there, and then everything would have been just fine. Right, Mike?
That's a great statement, Steve. Exactly that. We send all the complaint is, and certainly it's the Republican complaint in this particular administration, that we haven't sent more troops. We haven't basically operated these proxy wars, as Gary called them, in a half a dozen countries. Now, I know definitely, poll after poll. And I don't need the coffee shop for this one. Americans don't want that. We don't want our troops perennially stationed in a half a dozen countries, half a dozen new countries. Forget about the ones we're in right now.
They want a great big American footprint in Yemen. And they're blaming the Obama administration because Yemen has completely fallen apart. There's a war there and a proxy war between two factions of Islam, between the Shiites, the Hutus, and establishment in Yemen, who's Sunni. And why should we even be involved in that? I mean, who are the good guys?
Yeah, exactly.
The Hutus are supposedly, they're supported by Iran. Nobody denies that Iran is giving them money.
Nobody
and
denies
some
Saudi Arabia is.
But they're not agents of Iran. This is a movement of a very obscure branch and different branch of Shiite Islam than is in Iran. And they're there for their own reason, and their own reason is they've been persecuted and mistreated and marginalized by the Sunni folks in Yemen.
Right.
And now Saudi Arabia is heading for its own Vietnam by sending troops.
I was going to say, you made the Vietnam analogy, and it was excellent because if America gets involved, then it makes the Vietnam analogy even better. Some people believe one of the reasons we got involved in Vietnam was our French allies. That because they were our allies, and religion was involved in that too, that we had an obligation to help out.
All right. When the French bail out, we think we can do it better. That's the ugly American. There was Graham Greene's novel. We think we can go in there, and wherever the French failed, we can go and succeed.
But
let me ask you one more question. I know I'm bugging you stuff. But why is our response to all these crises always to send in military force? why don't we have any? It's like we have a toolbox where we have, you know, the Marines and the Air Force, and we don't have any other tools. We don't have a strong State Department. We don't have a strong diplomacy.
It's politics. It's all because politically it gets you elected. Politically, there couldn't have been a worse leader than George Bush, but because of his constant warfare, he made him look like a leader, and it kept him in office, and so for a congressman, now you have all these congressmen, you have all these senators getting involved in foreign policy in ways they never have before, in ways that are quite frankly damaging
to the United States and ignorant.
Yeah, I'm going to take that back. I'm not going to say they never have before.
It's been much of our history.
I've been doing some reading but it's always been detrimental. It's almost always been detrimental.
Well, everyone takes a simplistic view to these things. If we just go in and bomb
just a few bombs, was that Cotton? Senator Cotton? Just a few bombs.
If we take out Saddam Hussein, then everything will be
okay. Right.
You know, the repercussions of these, I mean, like ISIS was really, you could make a strong case that ISIS is the result of the de-bathification by Paul Bremer of Iraq.
A neoconservative who's been put in charge of Iraq originally. He basically sidelined and marginalized the Sunnis who had supported Saddam Hussein.
He threw out all the military leaders. He threw out, even the utilities operators and the school teachers. Yeah. Anyone who had a tie to the Ba'athist Party, which was the party of Saddam Hussein.
Oh, and that were keeping order in a country of so many millions of people.
So he basically threw them all out of their positions, made them unemployed. And now the generals in ISIS, from what I've read, are pretty much all of the former Ba'athist leaders.
The other thing that strikes me is the surge. The surge was presented as this huge success in Iraq. Nobody's presented it as being a very big success in Afghanistan. It just didn't seem to make much difference in what's happening in Afghanistan. When you look at the politics of the Taliban and the Afghanistani government, the surge in a few provinces in Afghanistan, but it appeared to be a great huge victory in Iraq, but it wasn't, because all it did was kill off the large military groupings of the opposition of Al-Qaeda. It killed off their leadership. The surge did that. It drove them underground. They came up with new and, frankly, better leadership and emerged as an even more vicious organization than before.
Well, it's just my analogy. It's just like raising a teenage daughter. And anybody that's tried to raise a teenager knows that you can't react to everything that that person says or does. If you try to react to every event, all it does is muddy things so much worse. And so what I see is so, you know, there's a particular conflict or activity in Afghanistan or in Iraq or with Iran powers, you know, between the moderates and the less moderate. And then the United States tries to manipulate that, tries to get in there and like the, some of the Republicans in Congress want us to do, either diplomatically, which
John McCain is one of the worst, right?
And or the first thing we do is send in the military. One of the reasons I was going to say I think the military gets sent in, but let me finish the teenage daughter analogy. You know, it's so much better to wait and find out where it's going, because chances are really good it's going nowhere that you care about. You know, there's going to be no danger to the child. It's going to be forgotten. It's going to move on to some other thing that you may have to deal with. So reacting to every
and that's what we do, basically.
And that's what we do.
There's press hysteria, and there's this kind of establishment, right?
That's what I want us to do.
There's establishment of interventionists in Washington,
yes, without a doubt,
that have a tremendous amount of power, whoever is president, who want these interventions. And I think you're right, Mike, because I think that the first time they see a problem, they just want to intervene. Like, what should you do in Yemen? Well, you don't know what to do, so you shouldn't go and do something if you don't have a clue how to help the situation. Same way in Syria. I mean, there are almost no good guys in Syria. There's all these different factions and stuff. None of them really worthy of support. They finally basically put Obama in a corner, so he's supporting, hopefully, what do they call them, vetted Syrian opposition who are not, you know, really Al-Qaeda in disguise. Sorry. But there's a lot of good people in Syria, and there's a lot of people just struggling to survive, and there's frightened minority groups. But the armed factions, why support any of them?
Syria is a great example of repercussions and not knowing what's going on. McCain and Lindsey Graham and company wanted to arm the rebels against Assad without really even vetting, as you mentioned, the people that were fighting, the rebels that were fighting. Arms are one of the biggest issues, one of the biggest unintended consequences comes from our arms sales. We're the number one arms dealer in the world by far. And our weapons, like ISIS, is now using, you know, our own weapons against us. They were taken from the Iraqis and from the rebels.
But as I was saying earlier, Gary, that's, you know, if you're an arms dealer, and that's all good. The ISIS ended up with all our weapons. They used them against the Iraqis and the Kurds and anybody else who happened to be in the area. And then we get to sell more weapons to Iraq, right?
And then the other thing, you know, I think another example of this is Afghanistan, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. We started arming the rebels to fight back, and then we also provided textbooks to encourage these people to dislike the Soviets, the Westerners, the Western invaders. Well, the Taliban is a direct result of that, and they're using our own Stinger missiles and weapons back against us, the ones that we provided them back then.
We funded and supported the most conservative elements in Afghan society. A lot of the Taliban were against the communist socialist government, which certainly had its problem, because of two issues. land redistribution from the very wealthy to everybody else, and rights of women. And what happens when the left is in control in Afghanistan is the rights of women increase, the number of women in every field goes up. They're empowered. This infuriates the far right and the traditionalists in Afghanistan, and those are the Taliban who were pouring, the pre-Taliban and Taliban who were pouring money into.
Getting back to the Iran nuclear thing, or at least to talk about that interventionism that's looming or posing, or the drums for war are beating, and certainly in some circles. I try to follow the logic, and the logic is if you bomb Iran, then they won't have a nuclear weapon. It won't take away their desire for a nuclear weapon, or, quite frankly, their need, what they see as their need.
It will speed it up.
Well, it'll delay it a few years. You know, we're bound to hit some targets that will... So if Israel does it, of course, then they'll be all out war. I don't care if they have to go after them with pitchforks. So the United States it has to go in and be Israel's champion, take Iran back to, 1985 and its nuclear effort. But they're going to redouble their efforts. What I've heard that would work is a more aggressive diplomatic strategy. In other words, just like you would that teenage daughter, tie not doing pursuing more nuclear things.
Well, I think that
with sanctions, with raising sanctions, with relieving sanctions, make that a real aggressive strategy. Say, do this. Don't do this, get this. Don't do this, get this.
Well, I think that's what the agreement amounts to, that the framework of the agreement that's been amounted to.
Now, which caused the Iranians to party in the streets.
I know. And it caused the Iranian leadership, the conservative leadership, to get really, really concerned. And I think, as I said, I think last week, the secret is that in this framework, the Iranians really gave up any hope of making a bomb anytime quickly. A whole year of inspections before they can get a bomb together. It's giving up being able to sneak around. If Israel or the United States bombs Iran, they're a country of 80 million people. It's a fairly large country, medium-sized country, filled with a lot of very talented people. And if Pakistan and India can make a bomb, if North Korea, crazy North Korea, can make a bomb, why can't Iran? It seems a completely self-defeating policy. It seems a policy that's coming from Netanyahu, who decided to blow this whole thing up so that he has an issue to frighten Israelis
so
in the elections.
Are you advocating that it's okay for Iran to have a nuclear bomb? And am I hearing that?
What I'm saying is that Iran's having a nuclear bomb is not the end of the world. Russia under Stalin had a nuclear bomb.
I mean,
China under Mao had nuclear bomb.
Logically. U.S. foreign policy is non-proliferation.
I'm absolutely in support of non-proliferation, but what I'm saying is that I think the whole thing is the danger of a single Iranian bomb is way, way overblown.
But let's think of what has been the balance of terror for 70 years. What if Turkey has a bomb? Iran has a bomb? Kuwait has a bomb.
I don't want any more countries to have bombs, even though proliferation because, it is true that if Iran has a bomb, then other people are going to want to have bombs too. And because there's a huge tension, not just between Israel and in Iran, who have almost no connection to each other except the Israelis want to bomb Iran and Iran hates Israel. The real competition is between Iran and Saudi Arabia over in the Muslim world. And that could be set off. So no one wants more countries to have it. But I think that it's been exaggerated, the results of all this.
Getting back to the foreign policy part of this, that we talked about last week, there are really only three options with Iran, as we said last week. One is the agreement that the framework and pursuing it diplomatically. The other is to bomb, which is so problematic is that there are multiple sites. It's not like we can go in and take out one or two sites.
Tell that to Senator Cotton.
And then everything will be okay. There are multiple sites. They're often buried deep in mountains, wisely on Iran's part. And if we do it, it's likely to turn into a regional war of great intensity. And then the third option is what the neocons want to do is increase sanctions. Well, as the news this morning pointed out, that's not going to work because the sanctions are already breaking apart. This morning, Russia announced that they were going to implement a deal to sell air defense missiles to Iran and then do a barter program of grain for oil. And Europe is itching to get at Iran's oil and natural gas because they have no supply of their own. So the sanctions, if this deal, this framework doesn't work, the sanctions are going, they're already falling apart.
Right.
And so now you're going left with two options.
The truth is everybody wants the sanctions to end and back to business.
That's right.
I mean, I imagine, and I've heard
that
American companies and English companies and French, everybody wants the sanctions to end.
But the
Iran to stop, and agree not to make a bomb, break all this down and get back into business.
But the Republicans still want the political points, and they want them big time.
They want to destroy the deal,
And it makes no sense. This is one of those deals that everybody should be behind. This makes the world a better place, makes the world a safer place. This is exactly what diplomacy is all about. This is just as good as it gets.
All right, so the military interventions don't
work. I
want to
say we'll use the military because it's so good. It's such a satisfying weapon.
Mm-hmm.
You use it, people say, oh, what a strong guy or a strong woman, and you get reelected.
And it makes our corporations a whole lot of money.
And we have an excellent military.
Here's an example, and it's one of many. One of the most successful programs the United States has had, and it's had it for 68 years, in 155 different countries, hundreds of thousands of people, is the Fulbright program. It trains and sends Americans abroad. It brings foreigners here. It has been one of the most successful programs in American history, non-military programs of interaction with the world. Okay? It costs a few $100 million a year. They're cutting it back.
Oh, they've been cutting it for years.
Yeah. They're cutting it back. Right in the middle of all this war talk, they're cutting back one of our most successful civilian programs. I mean,
that's where liberals come from.
There was some other news.
Come off at the source.
There was some other news over the weekend that pertains to this topic, and that's the Summit of the Americas that President Obama attended. And I thought there were two things that were remarkable. One, of course, was the meeting with Raul Castro. And the other thing that I thought that stood out to me was Obama's statement that I welcome is the days of U.S. meddling in Central and South America are over.
Amen.
I hope that's true. What worries us, folks, and I think what we were talking about earlier, is even if you have basically the CIA and stuff is telling Obama that none of these military interventions really work. There's some very narrow cases where if you have a number of factors where a military intervention works.
Yeah.
And they're telling him that by and large, they never work. I mean, an intervention in Syria can't work. An intervention in Iraq, unless there are people on the ground who want to fight ISIS, is not going to work. Now, ISIS is making a ton of, because they're so murderous, they're making a ton of local enemies, and the local enemies with the American support can fight back. But if there isn't that desire to fight back, I mean, look at the collapse of the Iraqi army. Look at the collapse decades ago of the Vietnamese army. Where there isn't the motivation on the ground by local people.
That's right.
you know, then what can happen? And I think the thing is that, you know, he's been attacked for talking to Castro, but we have a policy that is what? Almost 70 years old or something like that. I mean, Obama wasn't even born. I mean, Raul Castro said you weren't even alive when this, the boy, and it never worked. It never, ever worked. And we, yet we, well, it's controversial in 2015 to get rid of it.
When what I see is that the danger of romanticizing the Castros and the regime is real. On the other hand, there's a huge part in the middle where you don't have to worry about romanticizing Castro and Raul and still having normal relations, you know, having a U.S.-Cuba policy that benefits both countries, benefits the people of both countries to a large degree. This silliness, and there's no other word for it, it's silliness of 70 years of neighbors this close, of people who have so much in common, who have such a history, to have this artificial separation has been nuts.
We have normal relations with many, many, many countries that have human rights, a record of human rights.
But
violations.
It is true that when the liberals rush in and romanticize Castro.
I don't see Mike. I don't see any liberals rushing in to romanticize Castro in 50 years. I mean, nobody thinks the Cuban economy is working. I have never met anyone who thinks the Cuban economy is working well. They need to open up, as Raul Castro has done partially, but not enough, to private sector forces so that they get a mix of government and private sector. It's a great, they have great doctors, they export them all over the world, they do wonderful things in Africa against Ebola, they're a brave bunch. That's great. But that's government. They also need to increase their private sector because the economy sucks. Even if we end the boycott,
our largest trading partner is another communist country, China. We do business and have great relationships with Vietnam, which is a communist country. We consider Saudi Arabia a great ally, even though it has a horrible human rights record. And here you have, you know, an island nation that's really no threat, that is a we refuse to have relationship with because they have a communist government and they have a poor human rights record. Well, what distinguishes them from the others?
Let me change the topic a little bit and ask you guys what you think about this. And I was reading an article recently, and the question is, is our war on terror really like our war on drugs in terms of almost in other words, small tactical victories but overall strategic disaster? Are they similar, Mike?
Boy, that's a great question, and it's extremely tempting to say yes. I mean, and you could go down the points of the failure of the war on drugs, and you can go down the points of what the failure of interventionism, for whatever reasons, the war on drugs served political purposes. It always goes back to politics, folks. And interventionism serves political purposes, and it's up to those people that with boots on the ground, whether it's drugs or whether it's intervention, whether it's diplomacy, to separate the political from the reality.
But Obama has questioned the war on drugs, particularly it's a lot of the domestic stuff. But he hasn't really done anything about this vast infrastructure, and he hasn't really faced, all right, undercutting the cartels by legalizing, say, marijuana or something.
Right.
The first step is actually raising the issue. You know, something like the war on drugs and the war on terror are very difficult, complex issues that are political hot buttons. And so, you know, the first step of ending the war on drugs is to start talking about about it and what the consequences are and what the successes are. And I think that's basically what Obama has done. And,
but what you're saying is that there's that the whole in our series of interventions and also the war on drugs, the war on terror are so politically fraught with hot button issues that we can't even discuss them to get a conversation going, very honestly.
Well, not in this environment.
Can you imagine the reaction on the right if Obama ended the drug war tomorrow? I mean, it would be our children are all, you know, all going to be drug addicts. It just would be an endless attack. That's why I think you have to take issues like this kind of slowly.
But isn't there – now, here's the problem, folks, I think, is that it's unintended consequences. So ISIS is bad, and we kill a bunch of ISIS guys. I have no sympathy for those guys. They're fanatics. They're murderous thugs, and they'll commit genocide if they're given a chance.
If they're given a chance.
But every time we kill civilians, every time we push another country around, every time we go in, we create enemies. We create a blowback. And I think that what I see in the intervention is the problem of a blowback. And Obama tried to reduce the blowback by reducing the footprint. So we're not as visible. We're staying out of it. There's not a bunch of Americans wandering around. But that doesn't even – that's
well,
not
that
enough,
led,
right?
It led to the drone strikes. Not enough, no. Because you know, I think in Obama's case, it led to the drone strikes. But and the drone strikes arguably took out hundreds of bad guys. But for every bad guy it took out somebody's aunt, somebody's uncle. We're talking support for ISIS came, at least some people believe, through the hundreds of drone strikes and the collateral damage.
I think you can sum up Obama's attitude towards intervention and foreign policy with one quote from 2002. He was at a rally, and I noted this last night that he said, "I don't oppose all wars. What I am opposed to is dumb war."
There you go.
And I think you can see that attitude in virtually all of his foreign policy and his reaction to Syria and Yemen and other places, that he hasn't unnecessarily committed us to a war that we can't win. You know, that is actually going to probably cause more problems than it solves.
No, he hasn't done that. Give him credit. He has not done that. He didn't get us involved in Syria. We basically stayed out of Libya, pretty much. We're not involved directly in Yemen. And
Iran is not responsible for Yemen. And yet, and that's, I'm sorry, the other thing I see is that maybe this is nothing new in history either, but it seems new. Where the other side lies, every chance they get, they make false connections for political purposes. At least in foreign policy, where we're supposed to come together.
Well, to go back to the Vietnam War. Vietnam is a fairly small country. It's got a pretty large population. It's been very independent. Its entire history is based on basically resisting the Chinese. Okay. So if Vietnam is not a big threat, why do we care who runs Vietnam, right?
Yeah.
We care who runs Vietnam because the communist Chinese are behind the Viet Cong, and the Russians, who we want to fight, we see them only as surrogates, and so then we build up something that is scary. Oh, well, Russia is scary, say, or Soviet Union back then. And so then we come up with a reason. In the same way, I think in Yemen, the fight between the Hutus and the Sunnis and Hutus are enemies of Al Qaeda. They're, you know, so it is a really complicated situation. It's being lensed. It's being presented as an Iranian intervention. It's just not true. It's another one
That's
of
right.
these phony ways to build up support for.
It's fear for political purposes. And the other thing I think is the hypocrisy and the inconsistency of the conservative right with you know, prioritizing these issues in the Middle East while ignoring the issues in Africa and in Central Africa. You know, Boko Haram is every bit the threat of ISIS.
Absolutely.
And has been every bit as evil as ISIS. And I don't hear McCain and Lindsey Graham and the others or Netanyahu clamoring to let's go take out Boko Haram. You know, we ignored genocide in Rwanda.
We need to get some more American companies in there.
It's just a matter of what seemingly benefits our politics.
Okay, so we have our policy, you know, and so much of the time, the whole pattern of intervention in South America and begins in the middle of the 19th century, is always framed as protecting Americans from being attacked. I mean, then it goes all the way up to Grenada, and Obama even used that as the argument for intervening in Iraq. There were Americans in the Kurdish capital. ISIS is, and I mean, there's some truth to that. I mean, they would be in very bad situation. But that's always the argument for intervention. Why not? Okay. Why not use programs like the Fulbright? But why not empower more neutral forces like the UN peacekeeping? And UN peacekeeping worked in Congo. This is, we're talking about Africa. Namibia worked in El Salvador, Mozambique, Slovenia, Sierra Leone, East Timor. It has problems in Haiti with the spread of a disease, and it has problems in the African core that's in Somalia.
Who?
But
UN.
UN. Why don't we empower more neutral forces? What are we afraid of?
You can't win votes that way. It's real simple. It's once again, it's all political. You can't win votes with reasonable stuff like that. We do want to say right now, just at this break, that even though it's not a break, I'm making one, we want to get our plug in for our good friend Matt Capaldi on the doorboard. And if you like this kind of discussion, the Democrats at Red Rocks have a breakfast once a month at the Old Sedona Bar and Grill.
And it's this Thursday.
It's this Thursday, no
at,
less.
At 8 a.m.
At 8 a.m.
We have a famously liberal organization. By the way, there's lots of conservative members of the ACLU.
It's kind of non-political. It's, even though a lot of people think it's liberal, it infuriates a lot of liberals because it absolutely takes up conservative causes.
So she will be speaking there this Saturday.
Alexandra Solar is the executive director of Arizona branch.
Say her name again. I'm sorry, I stepped on it.
Alexandra Solar.
Exactly.
And she'll be
a guest on the show.
A guest on the show, or at least we're hoping to get her
on the show before.
If we can try to work it out. You'll be able to see what the ACLU is doing.
I think
that Mike and Gary are right. The ACLU is always lensed as a liberal organization, but they're willing to go to bat for any kind of conservative group that seems to have some sort of constitutional justification. They're not like their conservative dark mirror, which is basically structured to put forward conservative issues.
Well,
the ACLU stands for the American Civil Liberties Union.
So
they fight for civil liberty.
There you go. The Democrats of the Red Rocks door has these breakfasts every month. If you're looking for the kind of thing we talk about on Democratic Perspective and a lot more, you can go to the breakfast. I have free movies every month at the Sedona Library. Once again, almost always documentaries, always on political issues. So this may not be a university town, folks, but we have DOOR. We have Democrats at Red Rocks to at least encourage some sort of intellectual discussion of the issues outside of the beautiful
Sedona
boundaries.
And it is
Sedona
a discussion,
boundaries.
Right, Mike? And there'll be a speech, but there'll be the talk will be about half of it. The other
we don't
thing,
know
it,
how many people are carrying
be,
guns.
Will be a discussion that you get a chance to ask questions and discuss.
You can find this, that, and all other things on VVID.org, VVID.org.
You've been
been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.